Okay, welcome to episode 68 of the Ball Chats podcast, and we are again without I'd call him the captain of the ship, the guy who holds everything down and moves things along when the conversation gets inappropriate, but he's not here today. Mr. Andrew Bissett is somewhat out of action. I think he rolled his ankle mincing about on a football pitch somewhere. So, Bissett, you are sorely missed, and in your absence, me and Flynn are going to have to hold it down. Flynn, how are you doing, son?
I'm doing really well, man. Just excited for part two of the wrestling podcast and the bodybuilding and the strongman. And I'm just really excited. We're on the ocean without a rudder. We've not got our captain, and I never felt better.
It's a feeling of adventure, but a feeling of freedom. I was trying to think of a downside then, but I can't really think of one, to be honest. So we'll just crack on. And for the preamble ramble, in Bissett's honour, I'd say, we're going to talk about strongman and its legitimacy as a sport generally. This was peaked by a Guardian article by Adam Gabat, who looks like a very serious individual in his profile picture. And he's talking about how there was one Ukrainian athlete, obviously that being the flavor of the month, Alexei Novikov, and how he had to lead the European Championships. Now he's competing in the Worlds. And it's about the resurgence of the sport in general. Now, we were talking off air about Eddie Hall and Hafþór, what's his name? Bjornsson.
Yeah, Hafþór Bjornsson, something like that.
Yeah, Thor from Game of Thrones, anyway. And they moved on to a lucrative celebrity boxing match. But we were thinking, like, is strongman considered generally like a sport? Because I think Bissett, in his absence, we'll speak for him, obviously. I think he would kind of shoot that idea down. What do you think, Flynn? Is it legit or not?
Look, I think we all know that it is extremely legitimate. It's not just one discipline you need to know. You need to know how to lift heavy spheres. You need to know how to lift big tires. You need to know how to pull buses. These are legitimate skills that every man, I think, should at least dedicate part of his life to learning. So for me, this is absolutely a very serious sport. And I think Bissett would be hard-pressed to disagree.
Speaking of hard presses, let's go through some of the events. We've got the Atlas Stones, which you alluded to earlier. And this is a head-to-head competition between two of the giants that are going against each other. And there are five pillars with five platforms on top. One by one, in increasing size, you have to lift these massive stone balls until the end, and you obviously win in the shortest amount of time possible, having all five stones on the platforms. But because they keep getting bigger and heavier, the struggle becomes, by factors of 10, more difficult between everyone. And watching someone like Mariusz Pudzianowski, that Polish guy from way back in the day, mate, tip of my tongue, didn't even look that up. He's an MMA fighter now. He knocked someone out last weekend, madness. So when he was in his heyday, he used to just fling these things up, and he wasn't the tallest guy. He was like 6'3", 6'4". The amount of power, explosiveness, the amount of composure you need to have just to do that basic kind of trademark one, it is really impressive. And as Flynn said, you've got really practical applications of strength, such as an event called Fingal's Fingers. There's a massive steel pole, and it's attached to the floor by one end. And you have to just kind of hold it there in this really uncomfortable position for ages. Now, you tell me what Marvel action film doesn't end with the hero doing some variation of that. It's just, you know, I don't like people dismissing this great sport out of hand, man.
Look, man, I'm with you completely. You're preaching to the choir here. The first time I saw this, that was it. I was hooked. It was incredible. And even people who do look, you know, watch it to make fun of it and things like that, you can't deny that it is super watchable. It is gripping, just watching big buff dudes carry shit.
You know, even the presenter is twice the size of anyone you've ever met. So, you know, it's a freak show right there. And when there are guys wearing harnesses with massive chains and they're pulling aeroplanes, like actual aeroplanes behind them, how could you not want to watch that?
A big one as well is, we talk about this a lot on the pod, is about steads. And we all need to just come and accept steads for what they are. And I know for sure they don't care about steads in this sport. They're all off it.
I don't know, man. Do you think they're on steroids? Bit weird. I don't know.
Bit weird. Yeah, maybe not.
Bit far-fetched for me, Flynn, that one. That 6'6", 400-pound man whose whole face is red and he's just sweating constantly. Don't think he's on the steads, man. No. Have you seen, I watched some kind of documentary. It might have been like a strongman documentary. There's loads of them. But it was following Eddie Hall, the guy from Nottingham who broke the deadlift record who we were talking about before. And he was just constantly yamming bananas, eating handfuls of spinach, and just like out of breath, just sitting there, man. Because they have to keep their mass as high as possible. And it's not like a... It's not a bodybuilding competition. It's about how to become as strong as possible. Like, aesthetics have almost nothing to do with it. It's such a unique thing.
You're right about the aesthetics point, because they all look overweight when you first see any of them. They don't look like what you'd consider an athlete to be. And that's what I want to get. What sort of training regimens do you think these guys have? Because I know they have to eat tens of thousands of calories. I know Eddie Hall had like a 10 or 20,000 calorie a day diet. But what sort of working out are you going to do? Just lifting heavy stuff all day?
Well, I think there's a few schools of thought on this. And broadly speaking, I am semi-familiar with it. So some people think you should never, ever lift heavy, like as heavy as you can in competition. You should do lower loads for higher reps and just get used to the movement. And kind of ramp it up as you're getting towards competition, but in the off season, not really lifting as heavy as you can, because you'll just fuck yourself up and it, like, one rep maxes and all that kind of stuff. And having these events in quick succession, I think it really messes a lot of their bodies up. So I don't think you could train on that level and still be in one piece by the time you get to competition. So there's that big bald American geezer. Yeah, Brian Shaw. I watched a little thing on him. He was like a men's health, this is what I eat in a day type of thing. Obviously, 5,000 calories in a shake for breakfast, standard. 7 a.m. Like, it's like oats. You know when you're supposed to have like one scoop of protein powder or whatever? He's like, yeah, that's 200 calories. I just bank four of them in there. Like,
what's in that shake? Like,
peanut butter, honey. Just everything you need, oats. And it just... glug, 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 look straight. And then 2.5 hours later, he's having a full plate of food. And all of them, not just strongmen, but bodybuilders as well, they complain about, like, God, it's so, like, the hardest part is eating all the time to stay that big. Don't you think that's mental? That all that hard training, dedication, going to sleep at the right time, the hours moving heavy weights, and like, fuck, I don't want to eat any more chicken, man.
I know a lot of bodybuilders, they go for, like, super high protein diets for what? To help muscle growth and things like that. What about these strongmen? Because I do remember seeing a video of Eddie Hall talking about what he eats in a day. And it was just, like you said, he started with a huge protein shake. A couple of hours later, he had a full-on fry-up. And then throughout the day, he was just eating like burritos and stuff like that. I thought that looks amazing.
I don't think I'd be getting tired of that anytime soon, to be honest with you. But yeah, I don't know. It's funny how... The Guardian article was kind of saying this is a resurgence of strongman, because on YouTube and that now, it's not like you have to wait for it to come on ITV4 on a Sunday. Like, you could just look for the stuff. Like, the platform's changed, hasn't it? So obviously, if you're like me and you like watching buff dudes move big stuff, then you can just find it wherever you want.
I suppose before we move on, let's do the ball chat verdict. Sport, yes or no?
Absolutely. Probably the best sport out there, I reckon.
And I think all the listeners are in full agreement of that. So let's move on.
We'll run through the rough set list for today. We'll cover the football from last weekend. Obviously, the Champions League final and the playoff finals. Should we cover the women's? Was it the Champions League ladies final that was on, wasn't it, as well?
We did cover it a little bit last week. Yeah, there is the finalissima, though. Italy and Argentina.
Okay, so we'll probably bundle our way through that as and when it pops up, when we're trying to stretch the minutes out a little bit more. So going through that's right. As well as the regular top five things you might have missed. We've got Jags news, which is a new segment here on the podcast. Flynn is going to bring everything Jag to your ears, new, old, indifferent. He's just in love with the team. You're looking forward to that one, Flynn?
I cannot wait. I've got a lot of things to talk about regarding the Jags.
He's got to give a shout out to Tommy Ayers, isn't it, man? He's just gave birth to a new segment in his own absence. And obviously, at the end, we'll finish with the featured fight. It's a bumper edition this week because despite a slow week last week, there is absolutely loads going on in the world of MMA and boxing. So let's get back and we'll begin with the Champions League final, Liverpool versus Real Madrid. Did you catch any highlights, anything like that, Finn?
I did, yeah, had the game on, but I ended up switching it off about like 70 minutes in or something, because I think you're probably going to get into it. It was pretty dead, wasn't it? We really hyped this up and we called it wrong yet again.
The ball chat curse. I don't think we should use it lightly. You know, it's a powerful curse. I was actually quite enjoying the game, despite the nature of it being less back and forth. It was quite tense. I was enjoying the tension. I know it was one of the rare football games that I've sat down with India and watched from start to finish. And I know she was hating it, like nothing was going on. But the way both teams set up made it fascinating for me. It looked as if Real Madrid happy to sit back, defend deep and wait for the crosses to come in and pat the box to stop Liverpool coming through. Liverpool, for their sake, they look quite tired for me. One of their major creative outlets, our boy Trent, who we've been singing his praises all season long, I think he struggled to create chances. His delivery was nowhere near on par with what I've seen in the past. He was great defensively, to be fair, which is his primary job. Even though he was pipped at the back post by Vinicius for the only goal of the game, I still think he had a very solid game, cutting out a lot that was coming over the top and just generally being a presence at the back. They had to defend in spurts because Real Madrid were happy to give up the lion's share of the possession and depend on Benzema and Vinicius to hold the ball up and then wait for supporting runners. That takes some balls to do because you're counting on being perfect defensively for 90 minutes. And that's a really difficult thing to do, especially against a team like Liverpool. But I think they believed in the players, especially players like Benzema. He had a magnificent game. His ability to hold up the ball, like just do something with it, just hold it up, just fuck the defenders about a little bit, wait for Vinicius and wait for like Valverde. That's what happened with the goal, and Valverde broke behind him, slammed the ball across the box, and that's when Vinicius scored. But those chances were few and far between. And in the interim, Liverpool were throwing everything they could Real Madrid's way. But because they were defending so deep, any balls over the top were either getting headed away or Courtois, the goalkeeper and man of the match, he was just gobbling up everything. In the air, he'd snatch it out. Like, he made one bad boy save from a header down to his left-hand side. Salah was through on goal, one-on-one. That should have been a goal. Courtois got a forearm to it, sick save. Just, he couldn't put a foot wrong all night. And Liverpool overall looked tired. And I think they really, really struggled to match Real Madrid's composure. I think that's what it boiled down to. The longer the game went on, the less likely it was looking. Do you know what I mean? And I think in the last 15 minutes, Real Madrid made some substitutions. It didn't really change the game for me, but it was just fresh legs and, you know, more energy about the middle of the field.
We talk a lot about Liverpool having composure and being able to deal with these really high pressure games, but I didn't see any of that in that final. I saw them, like you said, I saw them looking tired. I saw Salah just looking powerless. The dude's like a magician usually, and they had answers for everything he tried. And why do you reckon that is? Do you think it could be anything to do with the fan situation before the game, or do you think it could have been them not getting the Premier League title? Any ideas what would have happened there?
I'm glad you brought that up, because for some reason that doesn't automatically pop into mind what happened outside the stadium, but it delayed the game by like 40 minutes. It kicked off outside the ground, like big time. And they're talking like riot police, tear gas, people robbing, like holding people down in the streets and robbing them. Whatever. I don't know the specifics of what happened, but it doesn't sound like a fun time. Do you know what I mean? I don't know what sparked it. Was it just general football violence, or have you read anything else about this?
I've been looking into it a little bit. So they've hired, I think UEFA's hired someone to look into it, a Portuguese MP who got a lot of history in events and sporting events particularly. He's come to the conclusion that UEFA should apologise to the fans, because it was initially they blamed it on Liverpool fans. And then, I mean, like getting a load of Liverpool fans, locking them into small areas and then blaming the ensuing violence on them didn't go down all that well last time. So it's quite good that they sort of saw that mistake. And yeah, it seems to be some sort of issue with, there was a lot of counterfeit tickets that were sold, and they would have a QR code on them. So when you go into the ground, you scan that QR code, and people with these fake tickets were getting in, and they must have been copied from real tickets because it invalidated a bunch of real tickets then. It's either that, or the ticket machines weren't working properly, but I think it's more the counterfeit tickets taking the spaces of people with legitimate tickets. So that caused a build-up. Then the Paris police started herding Liverpool fans into like dead ends and stuff like that and pepper spraying them. And I've seen some footage and it looked like they just, I saw them just pepper spray one dude who wasn't doing anything, like he's really calm. It was just looked like police brutality, a lot of it. But yeah, it looks like Paris police, UEFA, who organized this event. It looks like it was the fault lies with a few people, but not with the Liverpool or the Real Madrid fans.
Kind of nuts, isn't it, that they haven't got it absolutely sussed now, like how to put on a big football game. Like they happen all the time, like literally on a weekly basis. They should have the recipe fine-tuned. It couldn't be that much different at a Champions League final. I'm sorry, but they have football there all the time. It's France, man. Do you know what I mean? It's not Madagascar. Like they haven't got the infrastructure to deal with it. It's just shoddy, isn't it? It's just absolutely shoddy. And the QR code thing, like, it makes perfect sense. It means that they can employ less staff to man the event and save themselves money. And, you know, people are going to find a way around that. If there's not someone there to physically check you, people will figure out a way if they want to be there enough. So it's a shame that that was the experience so many of the fans had, especially when traveling, like, do you know what I mean? You're taking a lot of money, a lot of time, probably getting a bollocking at work for doing that kind of stuff and still getting sprayed in your face outside after your ticket's been invalidated. Do you know what I mean? It sounds like not the one, really. But yeah, as you said about Liverpool, what they're able to do in the Premier League, and especially what they were able to do at the beginning of this season when they were firing, as time's gone on, their energy levels have depleted. They've had the disappointment of losing the league. They looked a little bit deflated to me. And they were up against a team who had, especially in this competition, had shown their worth and shown their resilience and their ability to soak up pressure and be alive until the last. We talk about, it's almost like a lazy comparison now, but it is like Fergie 99. Like how many times they came back against the odds. It's like Liverpool 2005, when certain teams go on these runs where they pull out like last minute wins, like all the way to the final. Then by the time they're there, mentally, you'll have a hard time beating those teams because they actually believe in it. It's like City, they're kind of cursed because I think they always believe something's going to come up to sabotage that. Obviously, that's like, what's it called? Like horoscope bullshit, I know. But there's something to that, man. Like belief and where you think you're going to go after this. And add to that the energy levels, etc. And the fact, defensively, they were perfect for the whole game. Ancelotti, their manager, absolute don. And like, you know, if they've got players like Benzema, Modric had a wicked game. Like, what's his name? Alaba at the back, sick. Courtois, sick. They just played a more disciplined game of football, really. Real Madrid, is that their 14th European Cup? Something like that.
You got it. Yeah, 14.
14, man, that's some number. And yeah, just a shame for Liverpool. I wanted to see them do the quads, but that all went out the window after the league went tits up. So, and they did, yeah, they didn't look like they was in the game. But we'll quickly move on to the playoff final for the last of the football. Nottingham Forest returned to the top flight for the first time in 23 years. A Levi Colwill own goal in the 43rd minute proved the deciding factor. Huddersfield had two penalty claims turned down in the second half. One was a blatant dive, though. The other looked like it could have been given. So Huddersfield will feel a little bit aggrieved about that. Overall, judging from only the highlights, it was a dead game. But well done to Forest. And let's see if they can stay up next season, a la Brentford. It'll be interesting to see how they get on. So many teams just go straight back down, especially if you get there through the playoffs. The inference is you're probably like the worst of the teams to go.
I suppose we could also touch on the La Finalissima, the winners of the Euros against the winners of the Copa America. So we had, did you catch any of this?
Nah, none at all, man. None at all.
I caught a little bit of it. So it was, yeah, Italy versus Argentina in Wembley, I think it was. Argentina just handled them. It was, I think it was 3-0 in the end. When I was watching, it was no one had scored for most of it. And Argentina got their first goal in the second half, I think. And then just handled them, Jim.
This is where Messi broke some kind of record, didn't he? Some kind of vague comparison to Ronaldo.
So I was wrong. First goal came at 28 minutes by Lautaro Martinez. Second goal, 40, 5 plus 1, so just at the end of the first half. And then the third one was 4 minutes after extra time with Paolo Dybala. But yeah, Italy just had no answers for anything. They just got bodied, Jim.
What's happened since the Euros? They didn't qualify for the World Cup. Everything was compacted in terms of the qualifying schedule because of COVID. So the turnaround between tournaments isn't as long as it would usually be. So you shouldn't really be losing as many players. How the team goes together, that kind of synchronicity, how has that taken such a downward... Because Argentina, like, they're good, but they're not... You wouldn't back them to win the next World Cup. Do you know what I mean? They're not absolute world beaters. But they do have sick players, but their problem is always, like, just putting it together in tournaments since, like, the 70s, like, they just haven't been able to do it.
And speaking of, like, world-beating teams, Italy at the Euros looked like that sort of team.
Yeah.
They took Spain on, they handled England in the final, and they were, in my opinion, the two best teams of the whole tournament.
Yeah, it's an absolute mystery. I wonder if they've had a, probably should look this up, change of like manager, or because they've got pretty much the same amount of players. But Dybala, he's a pretty sick player, man. He played for Juve. I think he's moving this season, don't know where. Angel Di Maria, he's at PSG. He's been smacking it for years, man. He was part of like that old school Real Madrid team that were doing murders in the mid-2010s. And Lautaro Martinez, he plays at Inter. He was killing it with Lukaku last season. So these were like sick attacking players, really. But you wouldn't call that result, would you, really? Italy, Argentina, 3-0, Argies. Seems a bit West, man. But the World Cup, man, it's right around the corner.
It's going to be amazing. Is this still... You remember we were talking about Italy maybe getting a chance to come back into it? Was it if Ukraine didn't make it in or no, if that was it, Iran would get taken out of it?
Yeah, it was that one.
And not letting any women into the stadium.
Yeah, but I think they probably brushed that one under the carpet, being as Iran's so close to Qatar. I think they'll just allow it. Like, you're not offending anyone in Qatar for like doing that shit. Do you know what I mean? So, but we'll move on to the top five things you might have missed. And we'll begin with some boxing news. And Anthony Joshua has chosen Robert Garcia to train him for the rematch with Alexander Usyk. Now, their first fight was at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium last September. And Alexander Usyk moving up from cruiserweight, former undisputed champion there. I would say people would consider this an upset, but I don't think people in boxing generally saw it as that much of an upset, you know? Do you remember anything vaguely about this fight?
I do remember all the hype around it after Anthony Joshua got beat. And yeah, I remember, most people seeing it as some sort of huge upset. But then I remember speaking to you and you were saying, no, Usyk's incredible. And he's a technician. And Anthony Joshua tried to outbox him when that's not his style at all. Isn't he more of like a bully and a hard hitter? And he didn't follow his usual game plan.
Well, for the past few years, I would say that Anthony Joshua has been a boxer first and foremost. I think since his first career defeat to Andy Ruiz in Madison Square Garden, he got involved in a tear-up there where he didn't really have to, and he rolled the dice when he didn't really have to. And he did the same in the Vladimir Klitschko fight, which is something that kind of gets glossed over because he won by knockout in the 11th round. But that was an intense fight where he was knocked down, he was hurt, he was exhausted. And he ticked a lot of boxes for me that night because that was heavy weather in there, man. I know Klitschko was a little bit older, but I thought he looked great. I thought he looked better than he did in the Tyson Fury fight. So that's a really credible win for me. But then after the Ruiz loss, I think he had to reevaluate a few things. And like a year or so later, when they had their rematch in Saudi Arabia, AJ was on his bike the whole fight, man. He didn't stand still for a second. He didn't let Andy Ruiz get any kind of momentum into getting anywhere near him. And Andy Ruiz came in like fat and all that as well. But the game plan was superb. And I think since then, he's put a lot of stock in that approach. He did the same thing against Kubat Pulev. And I think he looked amazing in that fight. His hand speed, his coordination, the way he waited to land the knockout blow was perfect. But Kubat Pulev is relatively immobile. and compared with someone like Alexander Usyk?
So you mentioned AJ's chosen Robert Garcia to train him. Who is Robert Garcia? And is this, do you think this is the path to victory?
Robert Garcia is a former featherweight, super featherweight world champion who's trained like 14 world champions himself. A recent example of his good work would be what he did with Marcus Maidana. And if you don't remember him, he's the guy that gave Amir Khan all he could handle. He's a serious, serious heavy hitter in the welterweight division. He went to Robert Garcia for the opposite reason, to get his boxing under control, because he's a slugger, depends on his right hand. But under Robert Garcia's tutelage, he went from a guy on the slide to someone reinvigorated, and he ended up moving up a weight class and beating Adrian Broner and taking his undefeated record and taking his welterweight world title as well, which led him into two fights with Floyd Mayweather. And the first one, I don't think this, but people were saying it was close enough where you could have called it a draw. In the rematch, he also did good work, and this was all under Robert Garcia. And this is in line with what criticism AJ has received in the aftermath of that loss against Usyk, because people were saying, why don't you use your strength? Why don't you just bully him? Why don't you do this, do that? Use your size. Now, obviously, it's not that simple, because when Alexander Usyk is boxing you up, you don't know which way is left, which way is right. Never mind crushing him and just walking through punches. I don't think anyone would advise you to just walk through punches, but that's what people seem to be suggesting AJ should have done. So now I think he's gone with a trainer that has a history of putting his fighters in a direct path to their opponents. A good example of this would be Brandon Rios, who was like, he was like a lightweight in the late 2000s. Head first, forward, throwing bombs the whole fight. That was his style. And I think that's what AJ is going to try and recapture here. Heavyweight, it's different. You know, Robert Garcia said that himself. He said he's always shied away from training heavyweights because you can't do as many sprints. You can't do as many rounds on the mitts. You don't have to watch your diet as much. So that can lean into certain undisciplined habits in the training side. But I think this is a good choice. Out of everyone that's out there, I think this is what he has to do for this particular fight. Now, afterwards, it might be a little bit different. Moving on to number two. I won't say what I've put in the script, because that wouldn't be very nice. But this popped up when I was pretending to be on the toilet at work the other day. And it's from The Sun, and it is the worst kind of sports tabloid trash. But it really, really annoyed me. There's this woman called Taylor Jane Wilkie. And I hope I'm not doing anything out of order there, but the name's been published already. So I'm not the bad guy here, man. Send your complaints to The Sun. This bird, this lady, this young woman of the night, she was out in Dubai with her mate, and they ended up partying and ended up in the same bed as Andy Carroll, the former Newcastle and Liverpool striker. And she said, now bear in mind, she's taken pictures of herself in bed with a footballer. She sent them to her mate. She sent them to the tabloids. And then she's got the bollocks to say, I didn't know who he was. Didn't have a clue who he was. This guy, this 6'5" guy who's got all this money and all of his mates are like football fans. I don't know who that guy is. And also, nothing happened. So she's direct tweeting Andy Carroll's missus, being like, oh, I just want you to know nothing happened, etc. And she's claiming all of this while her face is on the front of that story. I was just thinking, who are you trying to convince that you didn't know who, what? You know he's got a missus, you know he's a footballer. That's why he's in Dubai in an expensive hotel buying rounds of champagne for everyone. What are you talking about? Now, let's just get down to a little discussed matter. Football players as victims. There's predators everywhere, Flynn. How susceptible to these succubi are modern footballers? What do you think?
Look, this, that's a fucking grenade you've just chucked at me. But I'll crack on. I'll crack on as we always do. Look, this could go one of two ways. I'm looking at it two different ways. That we take everything she says at face value. She comes across as a knob, And if we look at it in any other way, she still comes across as a knob. He kind of comes across as a knob too, because he's just out there. He's got a fiance back at home. He's out there partying, which fair enough. But then he's kind of ended up in this situation himself. Now, it just, like you said earlier, it's just the worst kind of tabloid trash. Like, who does that? Who's aspiring to be like her, to just be a good-looking girl who gets into these sorts of situations with footballers and then just tells tabloids about it? I mean, do people get paid for sending these sorts of stories anymore? Maybe she got some sort of payday for it. But some of the stuff she's done since, she's just a walking red flag, this young lady. Like, she messaged his fiance, and I'm just trying to find the quote now. It was like, "I'm sorry, Billy," that's his fiance, "I know how it looks, but we didn't have sex." This is like in public, man. She's just trying to humiliate this woman. Just for, I don't know, what, a bit of money from the tabloids? Or is she going to look for some sort of glamour career? I don't know, but...
It feels like that, doesn't it? That she's trying to humiliate the woman in question, his fiancé.
Oh, for sure. I tell you what it reminds me of. Do you ever remember back when we were young and there were two big glamour models? There was Jordan and then there was Jodie Marsh. And this is like before social media, but Jodie Marsh made a name for herself by calling out Jordan publicly in the tabloids or something. And then because Jordan responded, that kind of launched her career. And it just seems like something like that. I think she's just trying to launch some sort of career in social media or in the public eye. But look, kids, this ain't the way to do it. If there's any young girls watching, of which I'm sure there's loads, she doesn't seem like a great role model. But what do we know? We're hosting the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. And our logo's a dick.
When Jodie Marsh was channeling Macho Man back in the day, wasn't she? "I'm calling you out, brother."
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Look, it's for dudes. I don't think people get paid for this anymore. You know, like, I can't imagine it. Like, back in the day, back when, what's his name? Max Clifford, the old pedo. When he was in charge. It only takes so long. I'm always going to bring it up every episode. But when he was in charge, I think that's when this kind of like smut slinging was at its height. But now it's like everywhere, isn't it? Like, so, when you said that before social media, there was a before social media when none of this was the way things were done. You know, it's strange that we've crossed over that barrier and we're still relatively young. You know what I mean? I don't know, things have changed like a lot, but I can't believe you just brought that niche example, like Jodie Marsh and Jordan, the clash of the titans, man. But we'll move on. Sorry to have dampened the program, our usual high quality, highbrow programming with that smut, but I'll pass it over to Flynn for number three, for something a bit more serious.
Thanks for that, Jim. And now we'll move over to the world of real sports with some WWE news. Shout out, Bissett. So I want to talk about Simone Johnson, daughter of WWE legend The Rock. She's due to make her pro wrestling debut later this year. Now, some fans are upset as her chosen ring name, Ava Rain, doesn't allude to her father's. Some people have got like unreasonably upset about this, saying she should be called a Pebble or something like corny like that. But she's due to make this debut later this year. She was supposed to start last year, but she had a knee injury and had to pull out. So there's a lot of heat around this. And as we talked about before, the last time we had our episode and spoke about wrestling for about an hour, women's WWE is pretty good these days. It's not like when we were younger and it was just a bit of like a, I don't know, just a bit of like a light porn show with the bra and panties matches. It was actually like quite respected these days. And some of the athletes are awesome. And I'd be very interested to see how she turns out.
I seen a picture of her the other day for the first time, and it must have been about this, but I didn't know she was making her debut. Simone Johnson. You could not mistake this woman to be the daughter of someone else. If anyone's listening, Google her right now. She's more China than Trish Stratus, if you get my meaning. She's going to be a draw, isn't she? Like, absolutely. You can see it now. You can see her doing bits and bobs. And then, if you smell, then the dad comes in, just absolutely kills it. People's eyebrows all around. Three times the muscle mass he had in his prime, in his physical prime. He's so big compared to what he used to be. I don't know what he weighs now, but there's not an ounce of fat on him. He looks like mechanical. Like there's so little between his bones and his flesh. Do you know? He's probably one of the few people that needs Botox, do you know, just to give himself a little bit of cushion. Just some insulation to his face.
He's for sure on the steads, isn't he? Because I don't think you can naturally be that big.
Who, The Rock on the steads? Nah.
Yeah.
Nah, mate. No, absolutely. Yeah. I think he's on everything. Like everything.
He's gotta be.
Well, I think, what was it, Joe Rogan was saying the other day? Was it Joe Rogan or was it another like bodybuilding-esque YouTube channel I watch? They were saying like to be that big. It's PewDiePie, actually. I think he was talking about the double standard in like Hollywood of, you know, like Thor, that the other Thor, Chris Hemsworth, and that. A lot of them will have fitness apps where they're like, yeah, follow this workout, do this, and be a member of this community, which you have to pay $10 a month for because it's my private app, etc. And they're saying that these guys are selling a product that implies that you can get as big as they are just by following the diet and doing the workouts, but they're on loads of steads as well, and it's something that they just don't address. So they're selling this unachievable dream to people and taking their money. Like, it's really unethical, and it's something that's interesting as far as The Rock goes, because it's something he just doesn't talk about. He's grown so much. Like, compare him now to the Scorpion King. I know it's 20 years, but he's also nearly 50 now. Like, he's out of his athletic prime. So his natural testosterone levels have gone down, but he's put on however much percent in lean muscle mass. He's obviously on steads, but it's something that's a taboo for some reason. I'd like to know what it is, but I haven't got a clue.
I think you're right. I remember reading something similar about how it's like an open secret there in like the acting communities in Hollywood, that if you get approached by Marvel to do a movie and you're a man, they put you on one of these mad training regiments and they stead you up. And a good example is that the dude who was in Silicon Valley, he's from Pakistan.
Yeah, that guy. He's
Kumail.
He's hench.
He's hench. And Kumail Nanjiani, it's something similar to that. Yeah, he got super ripped in about 6 months, I think. And he just looked like he had a really regular sort of body shape. And then 6 months later, he's that ripped. I don't think that's possible. I think you could train all day, every day. And, well, eating chicken breast and rice is going to make you look like that. Impossible.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like, why can I see all those veins all of a sudden? Like, that's weird. Imagine if she starts doing the steads, man. Simone Johnson. I don't think her face can get much bigger. Do you know what I mean? That is... I imagine she waxes quite a lot already, man, to be fair. Which brings us... Oh, poor girl. I'm not being slack. I wish her all the best. But the stead talk moves us nicely onto number four, and Rafael Nadal, who I didn't know until recently, he's got this weird kind of debilitating disease called Müller-Wyse syndrome, which is an issue with his foot. It hampers his strength and maneuverability in his foot, and he's had this for years, apparently. But he's just knocked out Novak Djokovic from the French Open. But I was just thinking, it's been, when was it? When he 2008, I think, the 2008 Wimbledon final, him versus Federer. It was like a six-hour extravaganza, youth, dynamism, explosiveness, won him the day. And he's always been one of those tennis players that flies around the court, extremely strong, extremely fast. And now he's battling this debilitating issue in his late 30s. And I'm just thinking, keeping that longevity going quite well there, aren't you, Nadal? Because Djokovic was saying something as well. He's quoted in the article as saying, yeah, Nadal's always been like that. You'll see him one day and he can barely walk. Then the next day, he's like as strong as you've ever seen him. Which, again, high-level sports, especially tennis tournaments, quick successive games and training in between, you're going to pick up little knocks, little niggles. But for such a quick turnaround, when you're nearly 40, at the top end of a sport, doesn't really ring true, man. So the question is, Rafael Nadal, steads or nay steads?
I am steadfast in my belief that they are definitely on it. 100% he's in the Steds. You can't be like, I mean, he's probably on it legally as well, or like, you know, legal within the sport because of having this condition. He's probably allowed, as long as he declares what he's taking, to take certain amounts to help that issue recover. So I'm going to say, yeah.
That was the little loophole in the UFC for ages, wasn't it? TRT, testosterone replacement therapy. Or say if the UFC or VADA or someone would test your hormone levels, your testosterone levels, and it came in below the natural threshold for what you should be at for your age, they'll let you take steds, basically. But what major loophole in that system was that people who have been abusing steds, by the time they get to like 30 odd, naturally, so it dips to a certain level because you've been propping it up with like steds your whole life. So it dips. And then to alleviate that, they give you more steds legally. So when like Vitor Belfort, he was UFC champ when he was like 20 or something. And you want to see him when he's like 24, shoulders up to his ears, like just muscle everywhere, heavyweight champ. Then they start testing him. He develops like man tits and a little spare tire. Then he goes back on TRT. He starts head kicking people into oblivion, just knocking people out left, right, and center. And then he goes back off the steds, and then he's like average again. So he's like the perfect example for that roller coaster, man.
We've got to change the rules, man, because everyone's taking them, and the ones who aren't are getting left behind. And it's just got to come out. Like, look, steds are here. They're here to stay, and sports are going to be way better because of them.
Yeah, it's like it's just a weird image thing, man. Like why wouldn't The Rock, etc., talk about doing steads? They're in films. Like, what is the problem? I don't understand.
Exactly. He's not competing against anyone. He's just in movies. Yeah, just say and stop selling people your diet plans and things like that. I don't know if he is, but like you said, these diet plans get peddled out to people when in reality, that's not the only thing they're doing to get these physiques.
I don't know. It's all commercialism, and it fucking ruins everything. But in terms of even competition-wise, like, it's an unsaid thing. But why? Like, I honestly don't understand, man. BC is going to be screwing. Can't even get up off a settee with his one club foot. He's going to have to listen to my pro-stead views. But I honestly, I don't get it. I do not understand why you wouldn't be able to do that. Can you honestly think of any reason?
No. None at all.
And that is that put to bed. So we'll move on to...
Did we have a fifth one? Because if not, I've got a screamer.
Oh, yeah. Well, I failed to put in a fifth one. It's a good job. You've got one locked and loaded. Go ahead, Flynn.
I thought we'll probably change things up away from steroids, away from big buff men. And I've just jumped on musculardevelopment.com. It's a men's fitness magazine. And I just want to talk about... this month's cover model, Rafael Brandão, so from Brazil, really, really buff dude, definitely not on steroids. He's from Brazil. And as we all know, Brazil has been producing an astonishing amount of top tier talent in recent years in the bodybuilding scene, including classic physique sensation, Ramon Dino, as I'm sure you're all aware, bikini Olympia champions, Angelica Teixeira, and Issa Messini. And of course, the Wellness Olympia champion, Franciele Matos, just to name a few of Brazil's talent there, you know? But now, the best hope for a future Mr. Olympia winner rests in the man on this month's cover of Muscular Development, 28-year-old Rafael Brandão, winner of the 2022 Arnold Classic South America in Brazil. Now, have you heard his name come up in the community lately, Jim?
Only in my dreams. But in terms of rating actual competitors, no. I'm if you can hear me tapping away, I'm gonna try and get a picture of this stud. Oh my god, that's a human being. I know it's like semi homoerotic, but how is that not impressive to look like that?
It's amazing.
Yeah, he's a stud, man, isn't he? Look at that. Still got a smile. Look at those teeth. Unbelievable. Handsome devil.
The beefcake.
Unbelievable. Why are the Brazilians the new Austrians? That's my question.
They've taken over the world of martial arts, and now they're coming for our bodybuilders. And I'm all here for it, man.
Probably coming on our bodybuilders as well, man. So is this an actual thing? Are the Brazilians smacking it in the world of muscular development?
Yeah, just in recent years, apparently, according to this article, and I'm very excited about it.
Well, Pizzi said he went to Brazil and everyone was like putting sugar in their Fanta and that. Like, they're all meant to be pretty heavy lads over there, man. I wonder what it is. A supremely sexual nation, I've heard as well. There's a lot going on in Brazil, isn't there? Rainforests, Rio, muscular development, jiu-jitsu.
All the important things in life.
I can't think of anything else that they're missing, really. I mean...
Possibly lax steroid laws.
Possibly. Oh, here's another one. Speaking of Brazil and steds, do you remember Paulo Costa, the UFC guy who fought Israel Adesanya, the big, gigantic Hulk guy? Mm-hmm. Apparently, he's gone to get a vaccination card. He's refused to have the vaccination, but he still wanted the card to say he'd had the vaccination. And then the quote that I read was from the copper that got involved. He said, "Mr. Costa has refused to have the vaccination." At that point, the nurse was elbowed in the face. That is just, can you imagine? He's an absolute terminator of a human being. He's just tried to bully. I don't know if that's true, but that's the story, man.
And then what about his UFC career after that?
You know, do you remember? He's the one, I don't know if it was him personally, but on his account, they posted a picture of Rose Namajunas on Dana White's lap.
I did. Is he the guy who posted that? Oh.
He's on his account, yeah. And then Dana White was like, "Tell this fucking clown to take this picture of that now." Because anyone that goes against Dana White, who's been in the company, always says he's been shagging the female fighters. All
do
of them
they? Ah, oh, see, now, I don't know if we talked about this on the pod or maybe it was like just amongst ourselves. I've read a few things about Rose's husband, which are a bit concerning. Like, he's a lot older than her, which fair enough. Like, she's of age, but he started training her when she was about 14 or 15. Then, a few years later, she'd mentioned in an interview that they'd been seeing each other for 5 years. And now the problem was, she was about 20 when she said this. So it was basically as soon as she turned up in the gym, he groomed her. From the sounds of it, I mean, they're still together and they're still married, but I mean, it sounds a bit like she was a victim of abuse, like as a young woman getting groomed, but possibly being groomed by her coach, but definitely being groomed by her coach. And then the picture with Dana White as well, it looks really dodgy, that one. She's sitting on his lap. She looks pretty young at the time as well.
I don't know how old she was when she made her UFC debut. She must have been at least 18. I'm saying she must have been, but I don't know what the rules are there. Let me see. We've gone down the rabbit hole.
Steds, bodybuilders, pedos.
Save the best till last, mate. She's 29 now. When did she make a UFC debut? 29. Her and Pat Berry will probably get a divorce soon. She's getting a bit old, isn't she?
That's so it, Pat Berry. Yeah,
yeah.
That's
she made her debut 8 years ago, so she would have been 21, which is still though the 15-year-old thing in the gym. She looks young as well. He's like a massive brute of a geezer as well, like a former. I think he was a heavyweight. You know, do you know what I mean? That's suspect, isn't it? That is proper suspect.
I mean, it's if you're the coach, it's not like being a football coach or anything. Like, I imagine the coach has to get pretty physical with you in training sessions and sparring and teaching you grappling and things like that. Just imagine a dude like that training young women, and then marrying them when they grow up.
The full guard position is absolute like honey for a child molester, isn't it, man? Really? Like, they're lying on their back, they have to wrap their legs around you. Like, oh, this is just a position that's legit in jiu-jitsu. Let's just do this one over and over again. Honestly, it's true though.
It's absolute honey. Oh no. Shit. But if the more I read into it, apparently this sort of thing happens a lot with female fighters in MMA and in boxing as well. And I mean, it's very creepy feeling this.
Can't let your daughters do anything, can you, man? It's fucking screwed.
You can't. And now I'm worried about Bissett coaching them young women.
how did you fall into that line of work, Bishop? Yeah, I just went where the kids were. Had to be done. Obviously, we're joking, Bishop. We are absolutely joking. Oh, man. Bishop ain't going to be happy, you know. So we finished the top five things you might have missed, and we're going to move on to a much awaited segment, the Jags news from Liam Flynn. I can't wait for this. Take it away, Flynn.
Thank you. Thanks a lot there, Jim. So as everyone knows, new section of the podcast, Jag news. Let's get right into it. So a lot has been happening with the Jacksonville Jaguars this week. Unfortunately, we're not going to be talking about any of it. As our loyal listeners may know, last week, I dramatically switched allegiances and ditched my beloved Jags for an actually competent team, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So henceforth, our Jag news section will strictly be dedicated to the Tampa Bay Bucs. Real men pick their teams, but the titles of podcast sections are for life.
Right, Flynn. Well said as well. You know, all these impossible standards we're being asked to attain. I think it's bullshit, mate. Chuck the baby out of the bathwater.
I'm glad you agree with me on this, Jim. Real men, when the going gets tough, they switch sides to the winning side. That's how you survive in this life. So
exactly.
First bit of Jag news is the former Chicago Bears DL Akeem Hicks reached an agreement today on a one-year deal worth up to $10 million with the Tampa Bay Bucs. Now, as you're all probably aware, we're very excited about this in the community. Like, when he's on form, he's an unstoppable force, both in run defense and as a pass rusher. And it's my personal opinion that he's probably best suited to a rotational position in this point in his career, since he's missed quite a lot of game time in his last three seasons. But I, for one, I'm seeing Super Bowl rings in our future this season.
Bit of a coup for the Bucs, isn't it? The old the Tampa Bay Johnny Depps. They're absolutely smashing it, man. What would you say in particular invites the rotational system? And what is a DL? Is that a defensive lineman? or is that down low? I don't know, man.
You've nailed it right there. It's defensive lineman. And see, look, we've already got Vito Vera in the defensive middle area of our team. And the word around the campfire is that Akeem Hicks is going to be, their two stars are going to marry up perfectly. But it's a taxing position. He's been away with injuries, and we're just going to need to keep him rotational, you know, just so we don't break him again too soon.
Yeah, it's good that you've got Hicks, a player who complements the existing hierarchy in the middle of the field / pitch or whatever they call it over there. But what else is new in Jag world?
So, yeah, something else in this week's Jag news is this season, the Bucs are due to travel more miles than any other franchise in the NFL, with an expected 26,562 miles of travel. And you know, like, that's a lot of miles, more than like most kit teams combined. So we got the boys really need to make sure that they're on their A game. But interestingly, about 40% of that travel is for our game against the Seattle Seahawks in Germany, which brings us neatly onto our next point in the Jag news. The Buccaneers are the designated team for the first NFL game ever played in Germany, where we'll be taking on the Seattle Seahawks in a star-studded Week 10 clash of two strong playoff contenders. Now, the Tampa Bay Bucs, they'll be taking on the Seahawks in a groundbreaking game in Munich, Germany, on Sunday, November the 13th, just after my birthday as well. I think I know what I'm going to be doing for my birthday. And obviously, we're honoured that the people of Germany have chosen us to bring the beautiful sport of American football to their land.
That is a very low-key imperial move from the Americans, almost a century after the Second World War, to bring their to bring their flagship sport into Munich, into the heart of darkness. Would you make the trip, being so close? I mean, how far is Barca away from Munich? It's like probably 1,000 miles or something, isn't it? Surely. Cheap weekend?
Oh, it wouldn't be too far at all. And like a random weekend in November. I could definitely see myself doing that.
I mean, if you don't bankrupt yourself buying like a Buccaneers jersey, those things are expensive, man. I was thinking I'll get, who do I support again? The Atlanta, The Falcons. Yeah. I was thinking, I'll look at a Falcons one. The jersey was like 70, 80 quid or something. I was like,
And what about the books? Did you check the books? I mean, look, we're a quality team. We sell quality merch.
We're quality team. Feel the quality. No, I didn't. I didn't look at the Jags, no. But yeah, maybe I could get a little cheap on or something, because I like that old like mid-90s American hip-hop style anyway. So I'd wear it on that level. But as actual support, probably not going to happen, man. I haven't got the same fervor for my team as you have. I mean, I think that's clear for everyone to see.
I think the listeners can feel it. It's palpable, my love for this team. I've been into this sport for a good while now, and all I can say, it's amazing. It's changed my life. And I'm hoping if there's anyone on the fence about this sport listening in, they hear Jag News and they go, you know what, I might check out the books. They sound pretty good.
But you have got a lot of experience, as you say, and it's more of a kind of, you've anaesthetized yourself towards the boring aspects of the sport, haven't you? As I imagine all fans do. So it's, why wouldn't you want to watch a stop and start game for the better part of 3 hours, where the best thing is the singer at halftime? It sounds wicked, like, absolutely sick.
I'm just gonna take issue with your word boring. I don't notice anything boring about this sport. Every second of it is an intense thriller fun. Every single second. And the stopping and starting, I mean, you just need a breather from all of the intense athleticism that you see. I've got to say, I would not use the word boring to describe this sport.
Well, I think Tommy Howes hit the nail on the head a couple of weeks ago. He hated this description, but I actually loved it. It's like a team sumo wrestle, and it's entertaining on that level. But other than that, you know, they're just wearing more clothes and helmets, man. But the ones that catch the ball are pretty impressive. The ones that the quarterback running back relationship is impressive. The rest of it,
it's a tale as old as time. The relationship between the quarterback and the running back. I don't even need to go into explaining how that works, because I'm sure it's just everyone knows.
Yeah, it's assumed knowledge, isn't it? You know what I mean? Of course you know the relationship between the quarterback and the running back.
You don't need me to tell you. I mean, of course I could if I needed to.
Yeah, you could. I need you to.
And that's it. That's all. That's it for this week's Jag News.
We will have to wait for our captain Jack Sparrow to come back. But I think that should be a mainstay every week. I mean, especially when we have Tommy Howes coming on sometimes with his strict analytical, statistical knowledge. And, you know, I don't think if you two had an NFL off, I think I'd back you, to be fair, Flynn. I mean, you've just got too much skin in the game. You've got too much knowledge at your fingertips, man.
Well, you know, that tells me right away you're a winner.
I am a winner.
Yeah, tells me right off the bat. You know who to follow into war.
Yeah. And you know, if you didn't win, I'd switch to the other guy, because that's what real men do.
That's exactly what real men do.
That's it, yeah. So we'll move on to the featured fights. And as I said, it's a bit of a bumper section this week. Flynn, cut in whenever you want. If there's anything you're interested in, anything you've seen. We'll begin with the Showtime pay-per-view card at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York last Saturday, as Gervonta Tank Davis defended his WBA lightweight title against Rolly Romero by a sixth round TKO. And I think we put the video in the WhatsApp group of Davis pushing him off the stage at the weigh-in. So there was a lot of back and forth between these two. Like, and I've been watching Davis since the Pedraza fight, and the build-up to this was the only time I'd seen him engage verbally with his opponent, because Raleigh is this weird guy who's been saying all types of mad stuff. Like, he's got T-Rex arms and he's going to knock his little head off his shoulders. And no one really talks to Gervonta Davis like that, because he's got like 26 knockouts and 28 wins. Like, it's already a bad time. Like, you don't need to rile him up on that level. But Raleigh himself came into this fight, 14 straight wins, 12 by knockout, talking a big game. I hadn't seen much of him beforehand, but the little bit I did see made me doubt that he was going to win this fight. But after all has been said and done, like, I do give him his due. Like, I only had him a round down going into the sixth. He's a big guy. He's a little bit stiff. As I mentioned before, he used to do judo, so he didn't grow up he didn't grow up with these explosive balance-based movements, striking. It's a whole different system. So he's come to the sport late, and you can see in his movements, he's very awkward. He's got this robotic shoulder roll thing going on. There's not much rhythm to what he's doing. But he was quite effective early on. He kept the jab pumping out there. And Tank, being a smaller guy, that put him at a distance where he would have to pick his moments to dart in and land his left hand, which is what he was trying to do. That is a tall order, but Tank, being a smaller, more dynamic, more explosive athlete, he was able to do this, you know, consistently, especially after the rounds wore on. After a stalemate in the first, Raleigh really put his foot down, and he tried to be aggressive, and he tried to land punches against Tank on the ropes, but Tank was able to box on the move. He set his feet to counter, and then he just got on his bike again. And usually you see him go head first into his opponents, because he's so bullish, he's so strong. The uppercut on the inside is such a dangerous weapon for him that he can afford to be aggressive like that. But he boxed a completely different fight here. And the pattern that I just mentioned, Raleigh pushing forward, Tank standing, countering, then moving, that held until, I'd say, about the fifth round. And then Tank landed a left uppercut to the body. And I think it caught Raleigh on his protector, because immediately he let out a little yelp and pulled his hand back, and he was grimacing, and he looked like he really bust his hand up. And this was extra concerning for Gervonta and his team, because in his previous fight against Isaac Cruz, he did break his left hand, which is his power shot. And he was basically fighting one-handed for the majority of the fight. But I was thinking, what's the extent of this damage? Now, he didn't throw it for the rest of the round, really. And then I was thinking, has he bust it? How is this gonna play out? Because Raleigh's being aggressive already. He's already big, strong, closing that distance between them. If Tank hasn't got that left hand to fend him off with, he could be in serious trouble. But in the sixth, it became apparent that his hand wasn't as hurt as I thought it was. We never got to see how that might have played out, even if his hand was broken or damaged in some way, because in the sixth round, Raleigh rushed at Tank, and he rushed at him swinging for the head and body. And Tank uncorked one of the cleanest, quickest left hands you're ever going to see. And he was away before Raleigh hit the ropes. He was stiff as a board and struggling to understand what had just happened. Now, I don't know how he stood up from that count, but when he did get up, he was slow to respond to referee Dave Fields, who told him to walk left, look right, are you ready to fight? All that usual stuff you hear when a fighter gets knocked down. And he just wasn't happy with Raleigh's response. And that was a seriously vicious one-punch KO, man. I don't know if you've managed to copy or not, but it's give it a little look. It's frightening. Absolutely frightening.
I didn't catch that myself, but that sounds incredible. And what do you reckon? Has there been any talk on the left hand? Do we know if it's broken or?
He didn't mention anything afterwards. He actually surprised me, Tank, because he's from Baltimore and he's what you would expect from someone from Baltimore. He's a savage guy, and obviously I'm only basing that on the wire, but I'm pretty sure it holds true. He's a serious, he can be sadistic at times in the ring, but after the fight, he surprised me, especially after all the build-up and all the bad blood, because he was magnanimous. He thanked Raleigh and his team. He also claimed he didn't even throw the finishing punch that hard. He said Raleigh made it worse because he ran into it. I'm not sure about that. I saw the replay in slow-mo, and Tank looked like he threw everything into that shot. And it was perfect timing and the speed, etc. So I'm not sure if he's kind of patting himself on the back there. But Raleigh walked out of the ring before Jim Gray had a chance to speak to him, which I think is fair enough. He was probably still seeing the spirits of his ancestors after that punch. You shouldn't be talking to the media when you're that concussed. It's just not a good idea. But he did come out post-fight, I think, in the media room afterwards, claiming that he'd won every round until the stoppage and that he'd exposed Tank. Now, you know he still do Lally saying things like that. The only thing he exposed was that Tank could be just as effective sitting back and waiting for his chance as he has been rushing fighters in the past, which is a scary proposition for anyone else around 135 or 140. And on the undercard of that, 39-year-old Erislandy Lara repelled 37-year-old Gary Spike O'Sullivan's middleweight title challenge with a typically accurate, if wooden-legged, performance. Spike continues to summon the spirit of boxing's infant years with that trademark handlebar moustache and his shaved head. But his pleas went unanswered yet again against world-level opposition. Billy Joe Saunders, Eubank Jr., David Lemieux, Jamie, Jaime Munguia, and now Erislandy Lara. These are the best names on Spike O'Sullivan's record, and against all of them, he's shown the same limitations: poor balance, slow hands, and a static upper body. Now add age to those and you've got a poor recipe for beating Lara, who, even with poor mobility compared to his younger self, showed his accuracy, his judgment, his anticipation, his reflexes. Tremendous fighter. And he's one of those fighters you look at and think, what could have been if the Cuban-American situation hadn't resolved itself a bit earlier? You know, he had to abandon his family and come over on a speedboat when he was like 26 or something like that. Like, mad raw tales. Went on to fight Canelo, went on to fight Austin Trout. Like, his nickname is the American Dream, isn't it? Like, it's pretty sick. But yeah, Spike O'Sullivan's like, he's just a top level opponent. Like, I'd say he's European, between European and British level. And that's a really good standard for most fighters. But at world title level against this caliber of fighter, that was only ending one way, man. The left hook to the body was all he had. It was just, he didn't have the hand speed, didn't have the aggression. Looked like he didn't have the willingness to really put it on him. And this was the worst I've ever seen Lara. And he won every round. He basically won the fight in flight mode, man. He dropped Spike in the fourth. He managed to answer the bell. And the bell saved him kind of at the end of the round. And then he was just wobbling him with every left hand he landed until the stoppage. I think it was at the start of the eighth with referee Benji Estevez Jr. Calling the fight where Spike was still on his feet, which I thought was tremendous because he was only going to take more damage. There was nothing to be gained from keeping him in there. And I think Spike's corner should have pulled him out. There was no reason to keep him in there. So we'll move on to the look ahead. Now, from a pretty barren week, we've just got everything going on. And we'll start with, well, this was supposed to be the look ahead, but this happened yesterday. We've delayed our recording like three or four times. So 1-1-58, headlined by Tawan Chai versus Nicholas Larson for the Muay Thai featherweight world title number one contender spot. That was at the top of the bill. And that ended, let me get the stats up here. And that ended with Tawan Chai defeating Nicholas Larson by knockout at 1:42 of round number two. I've looked at the replay on Instagram. Smooth as you like, left-hand knockout to the Danish fighter. But while I was researching this fight beforehand and looking for like a bit of context, because I'm quite new to Muay Thai and ONE FC and that. So I was looking things up. I found Tawan Chai because he's got a wiki page. But Nicholas Larson, I couldn't find anything about. Like, topologies are the weirdest site ever. Couldn't navigate that. I think it's because they flip between kickboxing bouts, Muay Thai, boxing, maybe they do MMA. And so there's not like a consolidated database between all those different sports. But while I was researching it and the more I was getting into it, the more I was seeing a few patterns. So as I said, Tawan Chai, he's got a wiki page and this inspired me to play a little game with you. And it's called Guess the Thai Fighter's Record. So if you can give me the wins, losses, and draws of Tawan Chai's record, I'll give you some kind of prize when you come over for Bissett's thing.
Is it as outrageous as the dude we talked about last week with like 300 fights?
Well, this is the thing. This is the intrigue of the game. I don't know the upper ceiling of what all these lads are in their early 20s and they've got hundreds of fights. I don't know what's possible from somebody who's been a stadium fighter up until they're like 40 years old. So I don't know. So I would like the number in the win column, then the last column, then the draws. And I would just go by the article from a sports kid from a day ago. So this should be pretty current.
Okay. He's probably had about 20 fights since then. So this guy's 40, is he?
No, he's not. He's 23.
Oh, okay. 150 wins.
And losses?
27.
And draws?
Zero.
You know what? You're not that far off.
Nah.
You're actually not that far off at all. He's got 126 wins, 31 losses, and 2 draws at 23 years old.
That's outrageous. Like, how often are these guys fighting?
It must be once a week or once a fortnight. It must be, man, because I don't know where you'd find the time. But he's from Pattaya, and I've actually been to Pattaya in Thailand.
Yeah.
Were you there with us, or did we meet you after?
I met you guys after. Yeah, I arrived after you'd done that trip.
And Pattaya is the type of place where if you get out of a taxi, the first thing that happens is someone offers you the opportunity to go and shoot some wildlife with not very official-looking guns and not really on a safari-looking basis. It just looked like, you know, something super sketch.
Lobbing grenades at chickens.
Yeah, it's that. I don't know, man. Pattaya's dodgy, man. And then on the news, it was like another whorehouse busted, and there's like just hundreds of ladies, just like, you know, it's the prosy capital of North Thailand, isn't it? That's what I've heard. Cut this bit, isn't it? But yeah, so he's from Pattaya, a notoriously wild place in Thailand, and I think they have like in nightclubs and stuff, they'll have like Thai bouts. So I think it's pretty commonplace. That's how you amass that kind of record.
He must be fighting like at least maybe more than once a week. Do you think he'd have multiple fights tonight even?
Oh, that would have happened once or twice. Little tournament, little blood sport.
Little blood sport.
Yeah, a little bit of blood sport on a Thursday. Just to get the betting up. But yeah, he crushed that Danish lad with the left hand. So he's looking to be challenging for the featherweight Muay Thai title now after that win. And at bantamweight, another Brazilian. God, they just keep popping up out of the woodwork. What a great sporting nation. It's Fabricio. What's his name now? Fabricio Wonderboy Andrade. He beat Quan Wan Il or Lee with a knockout with a left body kick with a minute gone in the first round. Absolutely crushed him. And I watched a little bit of the build-up to this one. And that Brazilian geezer was talking mad amounts of shit. He was like, shouldn't be even be in the top 10. He's like, he's struggling to guys who are battered. Like, he's like, I can't believe he's ranked number 2. He's like, I'm going to destroy this geezer. And he did with a minute gone. So fair play to him. Big up the Brazilians, man. And I think that's all I wanted to do on the one card. Yeah. So that was the result for there. And now we'll actually look ahead to Saturday, and the UFC returns with Alexander Volkov versus Jairzinho Rozenstruik back at the UFC Apex. Now, both of these guys are coming off losses. We saw our very own Tom Aspinall slap that straight armbar on Big Volk back in March, while Rozenstruik dropped the unanimous decision to Curtis Blaydes last September. Aspinall and Blaydes will now face each other on July 23rd at the O2 in London. Go on, Big Tom. Do it for the boys. Which leaves these two battling for relevancy and their top 10 rankings. But I wouldn't fret too much if I was either of them, because heavyweight is a paper-thin division in the UFC. And there's a big drop-off from Francis Ngannou, Cyril Gane, of course, Big Tom Aspinall. And the rest of them, they're levels below that. And they're all on par. So I don't really think you'd drop that far out of the top 10 if you lost this fight.
This is a very soon for Volkov to be fighting again. Has he had to stand in for someone? Or is he just a nutter?
I'm not sure what it was. I don't think he's a late replacement. But think about it. He didn't get beat up in that fight, did he?
Good point. Yeah, it was like first round armbar.
Yeah, so like he didn't take that much damage. He just got situationally done by Big Tom. So... Yeah, I think the quick turnaround is it. I thought that, to be fair, when I saw it, I was like, oh, he only fought the other week. But I think if you don't take much damage, you'll be medically cleared. And if you're medically cleared, you may as well fight, you know what I mean? Especially against the chance to kind of overturn your bad form. I think a lot of fighters would kind of jump at that opportunity, man. But I was going to say, when's the next big UFC now? Next big one? Not like a little shitty one at the Apex.
The next big one. I have not heard much about UFC for a little bit. It seems a bit all quiet and on Dana's front.
Yeah, he's too busy getting on Rose Namajunas, isn't he? So that, the next one after that is UFC 275. Oh, that's Glover Teixeira versus Jiří Procházka. That's, I do remember that one now. That'll be good, man. Yeah, but we'll get into that the week before, because there's shitloads to go still. So
when's that to come? What, in 2 weeks?
Yeah, week after next.
Oh, okay,
it might nice. Even be next week by the time we do this, isn't it? But later on tonight in Cardiff, 14-0, Joe Cordina tops the bill for Slimy Eddie and DAZN, challenging Keiichi Ogawa for the IBF super featherweight title. Cordina came through the mad amateur hype. Like, he was British and Commonwealth champion at lightweight. The last time I saw him, he wiped out Joshua Hernandez in a round. So all in all, he's pretty quick. He's slick. He's up against a tough man here who's operated at the much higher level, though. Ogawa actually beat Tevin Farmer by a split decision in 2017. But the result was overturned because, guess what? He was on the steads. And, you know, he's my type of fighter. What can you say, man? Check out Dalton Smith on the undercard there as well. He's absolutely class. He's 10-0, 8 KOs from Sheffield. Still only 25. I don't know his opponent. That's just a proviso. But if I had to bet, they're still building him up. So I think he'll slap the living shit out of whoever he's fighting. He's really impressive, man. And the Ogawa Cordina, I'm not sure if this is a little bit too soon for Joe Cordina. I don't know if Keiichi Ogawa, I've only seen one or two of his fights, and those were like 3 or 4 years ago. So if he's gone over the hill in those intervening years, Cordina could look very good tonight and claim his first world title. So he's moved down from lightweight, where he's British and Commonwealth champion. He looks better at super featherweight, I think, physically. I don't know if that will hurt his endurance, but he's still a young guy, so hopefully it won't affect him too much. But over in the States, Showtime are back with Stephen Fulton versus Danny Roman. Fulton returning after unifying the super bantamweight titles against Brandon Figueroa in an excellent fight last November. Danny Roman has won 2 on the bounce since getting shaded by Akhmadaliev in 2020. That was another banger. Check it out, man. The little fellas always bring the heat, especially in world title fights. I like Fulton in this fight, and I can't imagine it being boring. But there's a curse. The ball chat curse is very strong. So watch that snooze you to sleep, man. But on the Sunday, and I'm not sure what time this is, I think they've moved it around to suit the American audience. So I think the card or the main event will be at like 10:30 p.m. US. So however that corresponds to Australian time, that's when it is. So George Kambosos Jr., he's taking on Devin Haney for 3 of the 4 main belts at lightweight. This just highlights how ridiculous boxing is. Kambosos holds the superior version of the WBA belt that Javante Davis defended last week. He's also the ring IBF and WBO champion after defeating Teofimo Lopez in an absolute banger last November. Devin Haney is the WBC champion, meaning this is going to be for the undisputed lightweight title, which is absolutely massive. He's coming off a nice run himself, beating Uriorkis Gamboa, Jorge Linares, and Jojo Diaz in his last 3 fights. Both of these guys are undefeated. Kambosos, as I mentioned, has the Lopez win. But other than that, I would say their records are pretty much comparable. Like, BoxRec lists Kambosos as the taller man, but I don't think that's remotely true. Haney is the younger by 5 years at the tender age of 23. And he's taking this fight at several disadvantages. First of all, he's going to Australia. Now, if you go somewhere where, say, like where the big star is and you're the B-side by a lot, you are running the risk of getting fucked over on the cards. You are definitely running that risk. Now, it shouldn't be the way. It is the way in boxing. That is just a risk that he's taking by traveling to Australia for all the marbles, which I love. Okay. Now, that was the first decision and the first disadvantage that he should be perceived to be at. The second is that his dad and his trainer will not be allowed to go with him because of a 30-year-old drug charge. So the Aussies are like, nope, you're not coming in, mate. So Devin Haney, remember, 23 years old. He's undefeated and he's been on the big stage a lot, but he's still a kid, basically. He's flying all the way across the world without his trainer, who's also his dad. And he's possibly going to get fucked on the cards. It's like he's at every disadvantage you can think of. He's got former light welterweight champion Zab Judah. His dad is going to be in the corner instead. So it's not like he's in there with a mug. Do you know what I mean? But I don't know what their relationship's like. I don't know how familiar, how comfortable they are. It might even benefit him, you know, to not have the pressure of your dad being there. I just don't know. But it's a change in his usual preparations. And time for the hot take. I think Haney's going to win this fight, man. I think he's going to win. Because style-wise, I just think if he can hold his nerve, that's the only question for me. If he can hold his nerve. Now, they're going to be fighting at the Marvel Stadium, which is like outdoor 50,000 plus. Like, that's a big deal, man. That is a big deal.
That's going to be hard to keep the composure. But sometimes when you've got all the odds stacked against you, that's sometimes the times when you can pull it out the bag, or at least elite athletes anyway. So after you telling me this story, I kind of want him to win now, even though he's a really big Teofimo fan.
You know, he's not an entertaining fighter.
Not Teofimo. Cambosos. Yeah. I really like that dude.
Devin, yeah, I love him. Yeah, I think he just reminds me of Chopper. Chopper Reed every time. He's super intense all the time.
Really intense in interviews. Yeah, it's something likable about him.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love it. There's no self-doubt. There's no fear.
None.
But I just think, I think Haney's on that same level. He's annoying. He's like one of those prototypical Mayweather miniatures who just like, I'm fucking untouchable, blah. I'm never going to lose. Oh, I got loads of cash. Oh, wicked. We know you've got money, man. They've got no crack in them whatsoever. He's one of those guys, man. But I think on the back foot, on the jab, Cambosos just has got a real problem. And I hope, like you, I kind of hope I'm wrong, innit? But I also, because of the situation of the fight, I'm also rooting for Haney a little bit, because it takes a lot of battle to do that, man.
Mm-hmm.
He must really believe he's going to win. And then he'll hold all the cards. Like, everyone's got to come to him then. Do you know what I mean? He doesn't struggle to make weight. He's still only 23. Everyone's going to want to fight him. It's a brave but intelligent play. Do you know what I mean?
You've got me hyped for this now. I was like, I might watch this. Now I'm 100% tuning into this one.
Watch it. It'll be a shit fight. Guaranteed.
So, they're doing it at like, what, 9 p.m. US times. I think it'd be fighting at like 9 in the morning.
Yeah, it's like early in the day. That's what they did for Manny Pacquiao, Jeff Horn. They did it like silly o'clock in the morning. And they robbed Pacquiao, man. They robbed him. In broad daylight, man. Robbed him. Yeah. So
that's got to be weird. Because I'm sure these dudes aren't used to fighting at that sort of time. I don't know. Do you spar that early? When you're
I think from what I've heard in interviews and stuff, a lot of fighters, the closer they get to the fight, they try and train at the same time as the fight's going to be, like whenever that is. So if you're in the main event on a big card, you try and train like late at night kind of thing. So, but yeah, no bother if you're like fighting at 11 a.m. Sweet one, isn't it, really? But yeah, finally, on the look ahead, this one's on Tuesday, and leave it up to the Japanese to do something random. At the Saitama Super Arena, which is possibly my favorite stadium name, the monster Naoya Inoue and the Filipino Flash Nonito Donaire will fight for the second time for 3 of the bantamweight titles. Donaire, he's one of my favorite fighters ever, man. He pushed Inoue closer than anyone expected back in 2019, survived a filthy body shot in the mid rounds, and he cut Inoue as well on his way to a unanimous decision loss. He's 39 years old now, yeah. Since then, he's stopped 2 young, undefeated prospects in Nordin Ubali and Raymond Gabayo, knocking out both of them in the 4th round and regaining a WBA world title along the way and setting up this rematch that no one was really talking about. But it became a necessity after he still proved he was a relevant force in the division. Like, Donaire, he was 36 at that point. He made it closer than anyone would have ever expected. Like, I knew he was crushing people on his way up, like stopping people dead. Like, no one could touch him. His speed, his coordination, his balance, his incisiveness, everything. And it needed all of that and youthful exuberance to beat Donaire on the night. That's how close he pushed him. This is going to be a sick fight, man. If if they're anywhere near the same levels they were at a couple of years ago, this is going to be an absolute banger. Like, it's a 12 rounder, so it's a hard sell. But if you're interested at all in the highest level of boxing, just watch the highlights of that fight. It's sick. So that's going to be the rematch on Tuesday. Oh, when am I going to watch that, man? When am I going to watch that? Okay, so that will be on Tuesday night. I think the question is, can he win Nonito Donaire? Can he wind back the clock and beat a man at the peak of his powers and pretty much at the top of the division? I think he can win. Do I see him winning? It pains me to say, man. It's kind of like, it's not quite what Manny Pacquiao and Errol Spence would have been. But I think Inoue is a pretty special fighter, man. He's got some deficiencies, but right now he's good enough to overcome them just with natural flair and talent. And I hope the shock happens, because I want to see the third fight between them. Can't see it being boring. Now I've said that, it's definitely going to be boring, man. So well done for that.
Their fate's been sealed, mate.
Their fate has been sealed, yeah, man. And yeah, that's about it for the retrospective and the look ahead for the featured fights this week. Flynn, we have managed to stretch out some incredible amount of time. I have not very much from the script this week. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling confident. I'm very sure Bissett's going to be happy with the job we did here today. And I think we should both be proud of ourselves.
Couldn't have put it better myself. Absolutely sweet. Bissett, heal up, son. I hope you're feeling better. I mean, at the very least, this podcast will be like the elastic band against your wrist. It'll be a pain that distracts you from your more present pain. So we hope to have you back as soon as possible, son. But Flynn, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. And I imagine I'll see you next week.
Thank you. Yeah. And I'll see you next week there, bud.
Take care, man.
All right. Good night, everyone.